and by which education can be amplified. But beyond the possibility of the individual transmitting the ethics and integrities of religion, all he can do is pass on something that the receiver can accept or reject according to his own conviction. There is no way that we can confer an inner experience upon another person. Thus we have the rise of a religious mysticism. And the religious mysticism scattered itself all over the world, making many sects, groups, and religious systems. But the only way in which it was possible for the individual to advance religiously was through a series of conduct changes within himself. Science works with the mind primarily. Religion works with the heart and its acts. That which it does and that which it experiences within itself. Therefore, in religion, the emphasis is upon soul growth, or soul unfoldment, or soul release from bondage to skepticism, ignorance, and misinterpretation. To accomplish this, it was necessary for the individual, as we find in the New Testament, the individual to transform himself. He must change himself from a mechanistic structure of muscles and bones until he sees himself as a living temple, that his real existence is not physical, but is in the spirit. If he can achieve this in himself, then he is ready for what might be termed a scientific approach to religion. Religion also has its science, which is generally more or less overlooked. The unfoldment of the consciousness of the being, the unfoldment of its internal resources towards ultimate personal experience of God. These unfoldments are according to law. The same universal law that keeps the planets in their orbits also tells the way in which growth is intended to go. That the individual who would know the doctrine must live the life. He must make those adjustments in his own character, by means of which he is capable of releasing the inner potential of his own soul power. This was a disciplined procedure. The ancients divided this discipline into two parts, the first of which they called a cathartic discipline, inasmuch as the first part was always purification. The individual must gradually purify his life of such attitudes and conduct patterns as are detrimental to his own good. Discipline in form of purification has never required that which was not obviously useful. In other words, it does not require that an individual shall change away from the practical to the theoretical. The primary disciplines of philosophy are really the disciplines of intelligent living. They are the way that we should all live. And the mystical disciplines are merely a gradual amplification of this procedure. For example, the first discipline of the ancients was purification. The simplest form of purification was taking a bath. It was a purely physical action, but it was a means of keeping the body clean. The next form of purification is to keep the emotions clean. Another form of purification is to keep the mind clean. Another form of discipline was the discipline of moderation, by means of which the body, being moderate in all matters, has the greatest chance of survival. The emotions, being moderate, also had the greatest possibility of maturing and developing without conflict. And moderation mentally means that the individual shall avoid those extremes by which his own life are endangered, or his own life is endangered. Another form of discipline is nutrition. Not to take into the body that which is useless and detrimental to it. Not to take into the emotions things that are useless and detrimental. Not to take into the mind ideas that are false and destructive. Therefore, right nutrition is that the mind shall have the proper things to think about, the emotions, the proper objectives for its their natural feelings, and the body, the proper sustenance in food. There is also another discipline of exercise. The body is exercised in order to keep its muscle tone. The emotions are expressed creatively. Art, music, these are the exercises of the emotions, by means of which they are kept healthy. On the mental level, exercise is thoughtfulness, the dedication of the mind to constructive purposes, the gradual purification of those attitudes which might cause the corruption of the individual. So the original disciplines of religion are nothing different from what they should be practiced by everyone. And there is no real reason why any scientist should object to it, because they would only make his own world more useful in his own life, more likely to extend itself to the maximum number of years. After the disciplines of purification were properly understood and applied, and the intemperances of the body were modified so that there would be no longer any interference on the part of the lower nature, so to call it, with the progresses and purposes of the higher nature. Then in peace of mind, gentleness of heart, and complete relaxation of body, the individual is ready to go into the more advanced disciplines until he is able to attain internal equilibrium. He cannot achieve the greater good. As it says in the Zohar, unbalanced forces perish in the void. Thus passed the giants of ancient times. Unbalanced living destroys itself. Unbalanced prejudices destroy themselves. So the discipline is a very simple and natural thing. The next phase of the matter was usually involved in the mysteries of symbolism. Once this nature had been normalized and was able to think apart from prejudices and deceits, it could contemplate the natural realities of life. The supreme symbol which is given to man for the edification of himself and the perfection of his own nature is creation itself. The world, with all its mysterious involvements, all of this vast pageantry is one great symbol, a mandala. And this symbol bears witness to the infinite wisdom of an infinite plan. So the meditating person, contemplating this mystery, begins to ask himself why things are as they are. And he begins to explore a little bit into the phenomena of life. He begins to see behind the surface of existence the causal purposes of existence. He becomes aware that creation is the fulfillment of laws, and the recreation of himself is a fulfillment of laws. As Paracelsus said, those who would understand the wisdom of heaven. He must walk the pages of the book with his own feet. Through experience, we gain gradually increasing respect for truth. But if this experience comes before discipline or before catharsis, before the disciplines of purification, the interpretations will be wrong. While the individual can interpret natural phenomena in terms of his own personal interests, he will never find the truth. If he uses all his knowledge to find ways of exploiting his own career, he will never find truth. To find the meaning of the symbol, the true meaning, in the universe, he must be without prejudice and without pressure. And this means that he must have quietly overcome the inconstancies and inconsistencies of his own nature. Out of this idea of a symbolical approach comes the individual exploring the commonplace, looking behind the simple surfaces of things to find what makes them work, to find what makes them do the things they were supposed to do. Gradually from this contemplation there comes a new kind of factuality, which is reality, in which the person, gradually moving through his own unfolding understanding of the divine purpose of things, reaches a state of admiration, of wonder, of devotion, until it seems that he can give all of himself without reservation to the magnificent reality which is hidden behind the commonplace. That he is actually able in this way to completely convert himself to the reality of deity. That he is no longer a thought, no longer a symbol. He is no longer a member of something because he has been baptized. He is a member of something free and in the spirit, simply because the investigation of the commonplace has revealed to him, as Lord Bacon puts it, that no miracles are necessary. The commonplace is itself sufficiently miraculous. This brings us slowly into a focal point, which is actually religion. Religion is the individual beginning with a single step, faith, and continuing until he justifies his own faith by the continual growth of himself. And when he has achieved this, there is no longer any doubt or uncertainty in his nature. And he also, in the course of this growth, discovers his common responsibility for service with all others and all creatures that exist in the world. It is a motion from diversity to unity, to borrow the Pythagorean theory, in which the individual gradually comes to know that the universe is one, a complete unit, and that diversities of all kinds are merely expressions within that one, and the unity itself of reality can never be divided. In the same general way now, we go down to the scientific level. Are we dealing with anything essentially different? We are dealing with the surface, theology with the depth. But the surface itself is just as much a part of the book of life as the depth. The scientist has every possible inducement to solve the questions that he asks himself. He has, however, tried to build the answers to these questions, not from the personal experience of growth, but by combining the testimonies of other workers in the same fields. He takes the attitude, for instance, that if five very distinguished scientists agree on this point, that point is true. He has not proved it for himself. He has assumed it. He would like to prove it, and perhaps his own experiences and experiments support, at least in part, the point of view which he wishes and will accept. but he has not experienced it. He has not gone beyond the pattern of his own intellectualism. He cannot, and has not, as yet at least, been able to find the silence in himself so that his final hypothesis becomes in turn a symbol. He has not reached the point in which he understands that every scientific principle he is working with, every discovery he makes in any field of energy, time, or space, is merely a symbol of an eternal principle. And that this eternal principle, though diversified through time and space, is ever and always has been the substance which we call God. If the scientist goes far enough, he's going to inevitably come to that point in his own researches when he realizes that the universe is a magnificent, intelligent structure enlivened by a divine power. He is going to find it necessary to understand this in order to answer the final questions that will arise in his own mind. So today, science is not irreconcilable with religion. And in the life of the average person, there are certain things that I think we can all work with. We can look for the symbolisms in science, and we can look for the symbolisms in religion. We work every day with commonplace things that science has given us. These things can stimulate in us a specialized sense of values. We can discriminate in the use of scientific knowledge. For example, a commonplace instance that we all recognize today. Science has given us the television set, but it has not discriminated. It has not told us how to use it. And it will not tell us how to use it, because by this time it has been so involved in a commercial situation that any major change would seem detrimental to the survival of the industry. Yet the individual can do exactly as his own consciousness dictates. He can use it as the basis of self-discipline. He can use it as a means of releasing his own sense of values. He can use it in order to determine that which is suitable to him and that which is not suitable. And every program, every evening, is an experience from which a certain profit can be taken, or it is an experience which is a total waste of time, or worse. But everything that we know, our utilities, our automobiles, all of our scientific discoveries, all our discoveries in drugs and things of this kind, all demand something that science can't bestow, and that's discriminating use. That discriminating use rests with the individual. And the highest form of discriminating use is observed in those who are religiously oriented. It is very seldom that a materialist will have the same discrimination in determining what is good for himself, or his family, or his world. Therefore, out of the scientific progress, we can all read a little. We can observe with some thoughtfulness opinions concerning space travel. We can consider with thought as all of the modern devices that are being developed. We can also read with a certain amount of anxiety the troubled story of the abuses of knowledge. We can learn the waste of values, how in the name of profit science is being used to support extravagances and to maintain vanities. These things science disclaims responsibility for. It says we invented it, people will use it as they please. This is probably a mistaken idea, but it is an escape for the individual who does not wish to face his own conscience. But even if he is unable to discipline his own discoveries, every person who makes use of his inventiveness can discipline his own use. He can gradually spiritualize his attitudes toward these things which he has regarded as indispensable. He will discover the billions he is wasting on vanity. He will recognize the importance of moderate living, of economy. He will begin perhaps to develop a certain sense of economic honesty in which he will not hazard his own future by unnecessary spending. Everything that we have can be abused. Ignorance will abuse it. Wisdom will use it well. It's all in the use factor. So science can give us things, and religion can help us to administer so-called progress, that it will never lose its integrity. One thing that we have to realize, and thus we do more and more, is that no one can take away from us the right or the means of personal decision. The only way in which we can get into trouble is to accept temptation and be over-influenced by it. If we decide that we are going to live on a certain level of consciousness, we can. And nothing that is done around us can actually prevent us from doing this. It may be difficult, and it has been well reported that the better we live, the more difficult living becomes. But it really isn't quite that way. It looks that way from the outside. But the individual whose life has new complications because of his integrities also has new integrities with which to defend himself against his temptations. And a right deed is no longer difficult if there is no temptation to commit an evil one. So actually, it looks from the outside sometimes that people trying to live well destroy their own advantages. But actually, if they live well, they have gained advantages in terms of value, in terms of realities, that far exceed anything that they could have lost. So we have now people who are working with religion. They are working with religion and are seeking to find a true faith. Max Müller, the great German Orientalist, said there was never a false religion unless a child is a false man. Some religions are simpler than others, some more complicated. But in all, integrities are approximately identical. And these integrities are the basis of religion, and they constitute the science of religion. For religion is a science by which man grows into the fullness of his own potential. And this is just exactly as important as the individual having larger and more expensive houses, automobiles, or other luxuries. Science can give him a better physical environment, but only religion can make him a better person to live in that environment and live in it wisely. And religion also provides the consolation so that if that environment for one reason or another is taken away, the individual is not damaged. He is not damaged because he was never enslaved to his own environment or his own possession. Today, religion is making, I think, some mistake in trying to term itself completely in the terms of science, trying to make religion sound scientific on a material level, and trying to create a system of terms or sects or something of this nature that will be acceptable to science. This, I'm afraid, is a lost cause. For the reason that no non-scientist can possibly have the knowledge of science which will enable him to discomfort a trained scientist. He cannot do it. His only answer is to admit that we have two different institutions, and that these two institutions can be compatible, but one cannot be forced upon the other, nor can one be interpreted in the terms of the other. In the same way, science is trying to arbitrate some of its differences with religion. The scientific arbitration, for the most part, takes the form of ignoring. It's just not discussed. But there is no violent opposition, except in a few activistic groups. The scientist is perfectly willing to let religion live. He doesn't entirely approve of it. He thinks people are duping themselves with it. But if they want to do that, they can. Now, if the scientist wants to know whether or not he is sure of what he believes, you have another problem on your hands. You have the same problem on your hands that was brought to my attention once when I was traveling in India. Namely, are these Indian disciplines correct? Are they forms of auto-hypnosis? The scientist is inclined to disparage them. That form of science which we call psychology is beginning to mitigate, to mediate between these things, and trying to accept what seems to be useful, such as acupuncture, which it cannot explain completely. But in this particular case, the Oriental told me, he said, send your scientists to us. Let them live with us for 5 years. Then ask what they believe. But to leave them on the opposite side of the world condemning us is unscientific. And the point was well taken. If a scientist wants to weigh whether or not religion is valid, there's only one way he can do it. And that is fulfill the laws and rules relating to religion. If he wishes to make an experiment in his laboratory, he has to follow rules or the experiment won't work. If he wishes to experiment with life, he must live the rules of life or the experiment will not succeed. Therefore, let him, before he decides, take upon himself the programs of practical religious living. Not that he has to join some sect or creed, but that he takes those essential spiritual values which have been disseminated throughout the whole world and apply them to his own conduct. Let him do his own purification. Let him purify the body, the emotions, and the mind. Let him rise above the temptations of avarice. Let him live in harmony with his own integrities. Let him do what he knows he ought to do, and perhaps what he learned to do at his mother's knee before he ever went to school. Let him be unselfish. Let him be dedicated. Let him be sure that his discoveries and inventions will be of practical service, and let him work out of compassion for human need rather than for income and profit. Let him do this for 5 years. Then let him decide whether religion is valid or not. If he will do these things, I am sure that he will find that the improvements of his character greatly outweigh what might be called his scientific prejudices. He will discover himself as a living person. He will recognize more and more his kinship with life. He will find that the tendency to neglect or disrupt families will be less. He will have closer relationship with his children. He will have greater sympathy for the suffering of mankind and will be less willing to contribute to that suffering by advancing programs of armament. He will find that the mellowing of his own nature brings with it benefits far greater than his prejudices could ever confer upon him. Then let him decide whether he is going to be a religious person or not. Many folks do not have to make this decision today. The number of those who have quietly, internally, and naturally dedicated themselves to idealism is increasing every hour. To those to whom religion already is real, who no longer have to fight to believe it, who are no longer willing to be materialistic, an acceptance is the first step, but it must not end there. The individual who says, "I believe," immediately takes upon himself the responsibility to be what he believes. And this is where popular religion has had a tendency to fail. I know too many people who are nominally religious, but it has produced practically no change in their dispositions. They still have the same antagonisms and animosities, the same prejudices and the same intolerance. Nothing has been changed except a label. They have listed themselves among the redeemed, but show very small indication of redemption. On this basis, the membership is always going to be nominal, and the effect of religion upon the life of that individual is going to be very marginal at best. Yet a stranger looking on and seeing a world that calls itself religious, keeping right on with the practices that help the heathens would reject, asks themselves and asks others just exactly what religion does do. And this explains a lot of disillusionment in this area. Unless religion produces a marked effect upon life, it is no better than materialism. So on the basis of this, the committed person who really wants to try to do something must immediately go under those disciplines which we've already referred to. They must immediately begin the process of cleaning the inside of the cup. They must fight against the weaknesses and debilities of their own attitudes. And it is only when they overcome a weakness or correct a fault that they may be said to make a step in the right direction. So if we are more or less dedicated and want to be more so, the only thing to realize for the moment is that if the dedication is supported by conduct, the spiritual resource available to the individual will be correspondingly increased. And what might be very difficult for a person who has had no development of spiritual resource becomes comparatively easy after this resource has been established. In other words, as you correct a mistake, the internal integrity in yourself grows stronger, and you become more and more capable of correcting larger mistakes or of practically reintegrating your entire personality. As you grow through conduct, your resource in spiritual advancement is strengthened. And the main thing then that you have to be careful of is that this search for truth does not become too self-centered. There are too many people who are seeking for a spiritual insight in order that in some mysterious way they can profit by it in terms of advantage or social adjustment or something of this nature. Always religion is not for gain, but for giving. The individual should grow only for one basic emotion, that he shall be a better pen in the hand of a ready writer. He should work always in order to prepare himself to be an instrument of the divine purpose. If he forgets himself or loses his life in the sake of truth, then he shall have life everlasting. Thus, each person who relinquishes selfness becomes, in a sense, nearer to immortality. For immortality is selflessness. And its greatest value to the average person is that it gives to the person the clear insight that it is not for self-advancement that we grow, we grow because it is part of the plan that every living thing shall unfold its resources for the common good of all that lives. And the service of self must give way to the service of all that lives. This is a more or less advanced step, but it is the final decision that must be made. And those who make that rightly come very close to reality. Those who are unable to take that step find themselves still in the shadow of materiality. The materiality is not merely a scientific materialism. It is wherever self-interest dominates the individual. And self-interest is really the destroyer of the divine interest which we are all seeking to gain and cultivate through our activities and labors. So we can learn something from science. Science can help us to discipline and order and proceed according to a pattern, to stay with the truths as we understand them, to grow with the insight that unfolds within ourselves, and with each step recognize our increasing responsibility to the living universe of which we are a part. These things can be made relatively scientific. The scientist, on the other hand, can certainly find through self-discipline and through the quietude and through the reintegration of his own life further and further inducement to recognize the divine principle as the source of life. The disciplines will help the scientists to find God through natural law, through the divine plan of things, through the ever-unfolding mystery of existence. And the religious person will finally come into a compatibility with science. He will realize that science is a name for something that is spiritual, but we don't know that. Science is nothing but the vindication of the infinite wisdom and skill which governs existence. Science is the first recognition that all things are law and order, that all things have their proper times and their seasons, that the universe is a constant unfolding mystery of eternal life. And as the scientist comes more and more to that point of view, he comes closer and closer to theology. And as the religious person comes closer to the realization of the constant meaning, the religious person is not looking through natural laws for these things. He is looking through human conduct. He is looking for the inspirations that come in the everyday circumstances of life. The scientist discovers realities, so-called, or facts, with telescopes or other instruments, and the mystic finds the same mystery unfolded through the eyes of little children and through the commonplace things of life, so that every ordinary occurrence becomes an evidence or manifestation of a divine purpose. To do simple things beautifully is just as scientific as to measure space. And to discover through the things we do the values we need for living is to come in the end to the highest form of education. Well, thank you very much, folks. I'd like to mention at this time, perhaps, that our trustee, Dr. Marcus Bach, will be here next Sunday morning. Many of you know about his work and the very beautiful photographic and artistic work of his wife. And I'm sure you will be interested in the message that Dr. Bach has. He will be with you next Sunday morning. Thank you very much.